the general public, we need some things. Mr. Wormhole, I call. All right. So let's take ourselves back. Just refresh. Einstein produced this in mathematics, predicted his predictions, but why is everybody going to drop whatever Newton did and come up with his new laws? Unless it can show something without a shadow of doubt that it's correct. Now, there's a bit of an interesting story here to make it more human. Look at the year 1919. Remember, Einstein started special theory of relativity about 1905, and general relativity about 1910, 11, 12, 13, different versions and fine tuning and stuff like that. Took a while. We are very lucky. Einstein is very lucky that the verification, looking at, so you guys left, you said, yes, I need an eclipse. I need a lunar eclipse, a solar eclipse where the moon is in front of the sun. I need an eclipse to take place so that I can go down, or somebody can go down and verify. Now, the person that did this verification was Sir Arthur Eddington. Now, if you're a sir, it's the first part of your name, which is very important. Right? So Sir Arthur Eddington was a very well-known astrophysicist, wrote some incredible books. He was the pristine physicist at the time. He was the Stephen Hawking of the 1900s, early 1900s. But he wasn't the first one to do, wanted to go and check out Einstein's equations. It wanted to be checked out actually a bit earlier. Now, so Einstein had done some rough work and said, this is where my equation said the star, then we talked about this bending, this little bending of the light. There's some sort of a little distance inside there. Einstein figured out what that should be. After all, he knew his equation better than anybody else, so he did the work. Well, the first time he did the work, he misplaced a digit and was off by about 20%. No problem. That was caught by somebody else, right? Because they were just reading the numbers to see if you plug it in. Yeah, plug it into the non-calculators they had back then, so they just did the math manually. But I think World War I, I believe, was kind of broke out during that time, and that expedition was not allowed to go. Lucky for Einstein. Because during that time, Einstein reworked his equations, and he went, I forgot, my own equations, there's two pieces. There's a time piece and a spatial piece. I only use the spatial dimension, the spatial part of space-time to do my bending. It was off by a factor, too. If the event had taken place and somebody had gone to record the distance, it would not have agreed with what Einstein had said it should have been, because he made a big mistake. But he, lucky for him, and this is serendipity, is that means luck, is in the realm of science all the time. It worked out that he was able to do the correction and then pass on the information to Sir Arthur Eddington, who got to do this expedition, because he did not want to fight World War I. He was a sir, he had a lot of pull. He said, I don't want to fight, I'm a conscientious objector. What I will do is, I will, after the war is over, I will go and do an expedition and see if I can show if Einstein's equations are in fact correct, if it really does do what they say it should do. So, 1919, you can see over here with my little laser pointer, right? A little trip went to Africa, says Einstein and everything right there. Nice little spot over there. Took photographic plates and different teams in different areas because they want to make sure that they got a picture of the actual eclipse, and they had different teams of people all over the place. This little thing says where it's supposed to be, if Newton was right, this is where it's supposed to be. It was exactly within the error of the instrumentation. And there's the actual picture. That shows that there's actually a small distance, because the sun's not very big as a massive object. So it's going to bend very smallly. But the photographic plates of that time could actually discern where it was going to be. So, took Telegraph. There's the actual copy of the Telegraph that was sent back. This Telegraph went to nearly every major paper. Literally, the next day, every major headline announced that this gentleman by the name of Albert Einstein had revolutionized physics and changed the way they understood physics. Has caused all the professors at universities to have to go back to school. Can you imagine that? You're a professor at a small university who's heard about this, maybe not, because they didn't have the internet, so everything was passed through by journals. Just think about what it was like back then. Right? You'd get a journal, you'd probably get thousands of journals, and you'd take forever to read them. And then this major news comes across, and you're the head of your physics department at your university, and the newspaper comes to talk to you, and you don't know anything about this stuff. You're going to learn about relativity very quickly. I think that's one of the most, very few people have actually seen the image, but there's the actual image and copy of the test script. 1976, NASA verified it. We have these little rovers and beasties and things to Mars, and especially with Viking. And at one point, you can see during the simulation here, Earth and Mars were on opposite sides. The Sun was in between. Now, if the Sun is in between, and the Earth and Mars are literally on opposite sides, they don't want to make it perfect, if we just off a bit, we were sending signals. NASA themselves were sending signals back and forth. Right? Take a picture, don't take a picture. But we know how long it takes. We know the distance. But if general relativity was right, when it went near the Sun, right, there was a warping of the light photon and added extra distance the signal would have to travel. And you can see over here the excess time in microseconds. And it worked out to within, again, experimental error, but this extra distance of 37 kilometers was extracted because of the warping.
Nothing.
But as I said, nothing, but that means because our Sun is very, when it comes to stars, our Sun is a winner. Right? It is. It's just a tiny little thing. We're happy it's there. Don't get me wrong. Right? Right? We wouldn't be here if it wasn't. But it's the only device that we have, and what a great way of doing it. So another success for the space program. This is the exciting part. Now we're getting to the cool stuff. Einstein produced, remember his field equations? That nice little thing. Even Einstein himself couldn't figure out how this thing was going to be resolved. He didn't think anybody was going to be able to unravel the mysteries of this. But World War I was taking place. This gentleman by the name of Karl Schwarzschild produced what I call the billiard ball version of a solution for his field equations. Remember normal physics, you always talk about ideal particles, they're perfectly sphere, right? They have certain perfect properties. He did the same thing for general relativity. He says, okay, what is the ideal body? Well, it's going to be an ideal sphere. It's going to have uniform density. It's not going to spin, it's not going to rotate, it's not going to oscillate, it's not going to have any electric fields, it's not going to have any mass. It's just going to be a boring, everyday, big mass ball. He says, and because it's a perfectly spherical thing, the mathematics should be a bit easier to work with. So he actually produced this Schwarzschild solution. And in fact, what I'm going to do tomorrow, I'm going to give you a package that's going to summarize, you're going to get about 20 pages, 10 minutes. It's going to summarize what I call the anatomy of a black hole, some of the things I'm talking about, so that way it's pretty. It's hard to memorize everything I say, so you're going to have a nice little package that talks about the names and what they really mean and stuff like that. Plus, I'm going to give you some fun math stuff to work with. But I'm going to give you about 8 pages to explain how the fun math stuff works. So it is intense, but it is doable. It may take you more than a day, but you know what to do in 1 day. I want you to read it, and try some of the questions, and I'm going to give you the full solutions. But I'm going to show you how to tear apart his equation. We'll look at a very restricted version of his equation, but you're going to use his equation to see all the things I talk about with black holes make sense from the equation. You can see where it actually, the predictions come from. And so that you're going to have all that with you tomorrow. Okay? So he produced his solution, and he sent it back to his friend Einstein Albert, who was, had to do a presentation for the Royal Society of Britain. Right? This is where all the scientists get together. It's not like they have the internet, and they can communicate that way. They all got together at the Royal Society and did any presentations that they took place. Well, he presented called Schwarzschild Solution, the Academy of Sciences, during the thing. The sad thing to say that he due to the war, he received most people didn't die of actual physical injuries, they died of viruses and things like that. He died because of viruses and the diseases that were part and parcel of World War I. So who knows what would have happened if Mr. Schwarzschild had actually survived that and would have taken. But he produced the solution, and this his solution is the solution that nearly everybody knows and loves. Remember we saw that the embedding diagram of the ball dropping into that wire mesh and bouncing and things certain. This is all his work. Okay. And his equation is not that bad. I'll show you this. It's based, don't be afraid. Never be afraid. We'll drop. Okay. It's based on the sphere. Okay? Based on the sphere. Right? Remember we talked about delta S is the x squared, because there's a minus thing, so we have the minus t minus the time part. Then we have basically the x and y part squared. All these funny thetas and phis and the angles like that is just the three-dimensional version of angles. Right? We had an angle here in two dimensions, but when in three dimensions, if I want to say where that clock is, I pick a starting point, and I say, well, the clock is 6 meters away from me, but I have to go up this many degrees from the ground, and I pivot this many degrees this way. That's all these guys are. How far, which way I pivot, which way I pivot. And that's what this diagram basically shows you. So it's just pointing to a location on the surface of a sphere. He also has this unusual effect. He has this 1 minus RS, and he defines RS as 2gm over c squared. These strange curvatures. This RS, if you've done some reading, is actually what we call the Schwarzschild radius. Now I'm going to simplify this equation big time because we're trying to use this as a tool. And remember my big theme, physicists are lazy, right? I can use any notation. Remember, G is just a constant that tells me what units I'm going to use. Right? It converts from 1 unit to meters per second and all this other stuff. You get the value of G if you use an imperial versus the metric system. So if I want to pick units, why don't I pick the easiest units? I can use my own units, and I each have a way of transferring it back to meters if I want to. So why don't I pick my units where if I say my G, my conversion factor is going to be 1, because I'm going to make sure everything has the same units. And I'm going to call my speed of light 1. That's going to be its unit. And therefore, I got 2 times 1 over m over 1, which is a very easy thing. This is 2m. I can handle, I can live with that. So we get to use any unit that we want. Sometimes we're so biased because we're using kilometers per second or meters per hour or whatever. But if we can pick any unit that we want. So if you take a unit that everything is unitless, because all they all cancel out perfectly. And we get an answer which means something. And if somebody wants to say, well, what does this answer mean in kilometers per second? You just look at conversion rates. And that's most books have these little conversion rates. You went from feet to meters and you know what I'm talking about. Okay. So here it was. This is it right there. Now, this is the cool stuff. Because of symmetry, if I were to look at it, it doesn't matter. Because it doesn't matter, I'm not going around this sphere. It doesn't matter which angle I'm at, because it's symmetrical. So if I were to learn something here, I could learn the same thing from over there. So why don't I just stick in one spot and just look at what's happening as I get closer and further away from my mass? Right? It'd be the same as over here, I get closer and further away, because it's symmetrical. He made sure it was an ideal situation. So in doing that, a lot of this stuff over here can disappear. Because sometimes you don't need the other angle to say where it is. I'm just going to work with me going right toward the clock. I'm just going to go this way, this way. So all I need to know is how far up and how far I'm away. I don't need to know this angle because it's going to be the same anyways, because it's the same. It's symmetrical. So we do that. Again, here's the time-like metric. Just tie it in together. Remember we talked about T minus S, right? Time minus E. Remember the pluses on the time will change to minus signs? Right? In polar, the pluses will change to minus signs. And his metric itself, there it is, plus, minus, minus, it's exactly the same way. We'll do the nice little simple conversion. And I have a choice which way I would like to make plus or minus. So if it's space-like, I make the first one minus, second one plus, and it's time-like. Because I don't want to get a negative. When I'm solving for these things here, these symbols, right? My space, my time. I don't want to do a square root of a negative number, right? That's a bummer. Try with the calculator. So I'll just swap them around to make sure it's positive. I want to make sure time is bigger than space. So I always get a positive thing, and it's a fact. That's all I care about. So we call it a time-like form, space-like form. That's all it is. We just want to make sure that we don't put a square root of a negative number. But look at, see what that, all that equation? This is it. My time part, my r part, and my r squared of the angle. But this is just that arc part. Remember I had that diagram, I erased the little r theta? That's not this. That's r theta squared, r. Right? These little pieces right there, those are the curvature parameters. That's the only difference between Euclidean, non-Euclidean, flat versus curved. These are the simple little curvatures. That's all it is. And with that, you can start asking yourself some cool questions. So what happens with my object? Right. Now, remember, everything is the same unit. In fact, we like to make everything in terms of distance. You see one? I said, yeah, we can change. If we will write mass in terms of distance, you can convert it. You use time in terms of distance all the time. How far is the star away from it? It's 3 light years away. Okay. It's in terms of distance. We can do the same conversion for math, and I've got that as part of the product that's what I'm giving to you. It's part of the questions to show you, to take you through that process on the sheets. So it's kind of, I'll show you how to convert, then convert back and get your answer. But because of this, I can think of my radius in terms of my mass. So if my distance is equivalent to two masses, right? That, in other words, r equals 2m, I get an interesting event happening. I get a value of 1. And I saw some of you working on this with your little special groups. And the idea, what happens to position, what happens to the time, what happens to your acceleration when you're getting close to this event, which we're going to call the Schwarzschild radius. This is the event horizon we're talking about on a black hole. This is when r equals 2m, because when r equals 2m, look what happens over here. Can you see what happens when r equals 2m on this curve right here? You divide by 0, which is ugly. Okay. So we can't divide by 0. But if you get very, very close to dividing by 0, you know, you get big numbers. Things go to infinity. Right? So, and when this one here, things go to 0. 1 minus 1 is 0. right? So you can see that the dt movement, you can actually see how it happens. If your time goes to zero, that means somebody, when you're observing somebody on that distance, their clock seems to stop. Their time, their ticking of the time goes to zero. Just, now for them, there means something totally different, but this is, these are the rules that describe what happens. Now this metric creates this barrier, this crossing over where r is equal to 2m. And so they want to call that a name, so they end up calling it the Schwarzschild distance, right? Schwarzschild radius. And then they had to determine what r really mean. And you'll find that what we call R's are actually what we call R coordinates. And the only way we define these things in terms of the circumference, if we're on a specific shell outside my star, my object. Let me explain that. Right now, if I do a circle or I give you all a nice sphere, and I ask you to calculate the circumference around. Right? And you would sit there, it's easy, you would say, you got a formula, circumference, 2 pi, r. And I said, that's great, 2 pi r. And you sit there. And I said, now, use the formula, measure the distance around, and see if it's exactly the same. So before, remember, you sat there, you said, oh, I'm looking at radius, 2 pi r. Now you have to go walking around and measure it. And right now, everything's going to be the same. Perfect, right? Matches up. But because of the bending of the spatial components, right, you will find that the r that you actually, if you could measure from your shell to the center, is actually bigger than the r you calculated by actually measuring around. So the r that you got by using tape measure around was different than the r that you got by measuring. Take the Earth. If you went around the Earth and got its radius, like, so measuring distance around the Earth, right? Use the formula, got the radius, and then somebody dug a big hole and measured the radius that way, you'd have a difference between your expected radius versus your actual calculated radius by a difference in the Earth would be 2 millimeters. Not much. On the sun of 500 years. Not much, but it's there. This tells you how much the distance is going to be, right? And so this is the R that we talk about. We talk about this is the R we actually measure around. So you see a lot of equations here that talk about the circumference of a black hole, because we need to measure the circumference of a tape measure going around. And from there, we calculate the radius it's going to be. But that's not the actual radius flowing in, because we can't go inside the event horizon. We have a problem. Well, we can go in, but the problem is coming out. Let's see. All right? So this is, and it's not, like I said, don't be afraid of this. I'm going to make you play with this. Because these equations tell us the story of black holes. These are different Schwarzschild radiuses of different objects. Remember, all you do, you take an object, squash it. Squash it so that all its mass is inside that radius, and you get yourself a black hole. Isn't this number? Remember, I asked you to calculate using Mitchell's experiment, using all that? I think you got something like 8.8 millimeters or something like that.
Yes, yeah.
There was a way of. His calculations were, in fact, true. He did not. The mathematics came out the same way. Totally different interpretation about what's happening. Okay. But there you go. If you have an atom, that's Schwarzschild radius, human being, Schwarzschild radius, Earth, 3 part of the sun, the sun could overrule the laws of physics and be turned into a black hole. Right? The radius, that's the distance from the center of, and I'm going to be more specific later on, from what our unusual object is to the source of event horizon is only 23 kilometers. And then you can have light years sizes for galaxies in the universe and stuff like that. You got it? I'm going to give you an equation, and one of the sheets I'm going to give you, you can have a copy.
Yeah.
What's the
what's the
L-Y?
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Because, you know what I said, we don't actually have measuring consistency in terms of years. And we're going to do the same thing with max. So it's kind of fun. There it is. Nice simple formula, how it goes. But, so the question becomes, how do we visually understand this? Because we're talking about a bending, not only space, but a bending of time, which is four dimensions. And you remember the hypercube thing, how much fun that was, trying to figure out what to solve the number of sides and that, right? So what we do is we say, okay, time is easy. We really have one thing to really worry about time, on what elements. We got all these mental equations, we can do some math of time. But visually, see what happens in the spatial part, because there's three x, y, and z, right? Dimensions. We use these embedding diagrams. And these are the diagrams that you see that represent something. Now, keep in mind, this funnel is happening at every possible angle simultaneously. We're just looking at one funnel from one perspective. Because we're living in three-dimensional. So this thing is happening all over. So this little funnel here would be what somebody would expect mathematically if they're coming in this direction. If they're coming in this direction, the funnel would have to be pointing to them. And so we've got all these different directions. And conceptually, it's pretty hard to visualize that. So we're going to do one funnel in one direction and say, okay, figure out if you approach from any angle, this is what's going to happen. Right? And then a little particle will come over here and experience something down here, and some amazing happening on some theories right over here. We'll talk about that. Okay. Now I'm going to put all the players together, right? And because remember, we have the mathematics, we have the rules. It was a game of mathematics. Einstein had fun with these things, but he did not believe they presented anything. Right? People said, well, if this could happen to a star. Einstein didn't believe it would happen to a star. Anything didn't believe it would happen to a star. Nothing could do what the mathematics said. It was fun with numbers. That's what it was. It made some predictions, which were fine for over here, but there's no way you could have some of this, create this object where we could disappear and have all these strange parameters of time differences and stuff like that. So we're going to step back, we're just going to look at what certain players did. Because you're going to understand what black holes are, you have to see how it all came into being. So, Eddington, like I said before, he was the Hawking of his time. He was really into white dwarfs. He produced some of the best books in his time. He knew, next to Einstein, the most about general relativity. And he did not believe some of the exotic predictions, just like Einstein did. He had a problem. His area of expertise was white dwarfs. And I'll explain what a white dwarf is. But it's a special type of star that's kind of collapsed at some point. And he believed that this was the last stage in his whole world was this was the last stage of a star. When a star burns out of fuel, this is what it becomes. It becomes a white dwarf, and there it is. It just fades to black after that. It just fades away. But it's still a white dwarf. He didn't want anything else to happen to that. But the problem was, on his white dwarf, it radiates, because they could see and sense from the telescopes at the time these objects, like dwarf objects. They could see bits and pieces of objects that had a spectral type that would match a white dwarf. But if they could see it, it had to radiate. Right? You can only see something that radiates. But to radiate, it had to generate fuel. But according to his work, the white dwarf was the last stage, and so there was no more fuel to generate. So he basically thought that it would generate by slowly shrinking. Right? As it shrunk, it got more compressed, heated up. But his other model said, well, it was a stable size. So somehow it had to grow again to lock itself back into structure, and then shrink again to generate more heat, and grow again to lock itself back into this crystalline structure that he had, and then shrink again to generate more heat. He had a paradox. He couldn't resolve this. How could it keep shining and not shrink. But it had to shine, it had to shrink. And he couldn't resolve this thing. He figured it, he's got a couple more years, so figure it out. But that was his expertise. You know, he was the same guy that visited the solar eclipse. Same guy. Chandrasekhar. Chandra. We're full of sad stories and happy stories. Now, Chandra, he was about 19 years old. He was reading, editing his book. He was actually coming over to study at Cambridge, at the university. And he wanted to, he idolized him. Editing was his hero. So he read his book when he was 19 years old and actually resolved the problem on the boat trip across. So what Chandra did was he showed, and again, I'll go into more detail when we put all the pieces together, that there was a mechanism in which there was a maximum size of a white dwarf. But anything above that size could collapse a bit further to something else. He didn't know what the something else was. But a white dwarf governed by the rules of his mentor, Eddington, had a size limit. And once it hit that size limit, and he went above that, its gravity would collapse into something else. And he produced the mathematics and, this, and the physics behind this process. He actually did what Eddington couldn't do, but at the same time, showing them that Eddington was in fact wrong. There was one more stage beyond this white dwarf. Now, Chandra was working, because Eddington was at the same location. Chandra was working under Eddington, and Eddington was his advisor. Porter was his friend, and Chandra would go back and forth to see the expert, and say, "Sir," Eddington, "Sir, this is what I'm working on. I'm going to do a presentation to the Singing World Society, right? And this is what I'm working on." And Eddington kind of knew where it was going, and this was the first presentation to what was happening about this next stage. But Chandra hadn't worked out Eddington yet. It's just the first initial presentation. So Chandra goes to the committee. He was invited to do his presentation. So excited. Can you imagine that? You're doing this presentation and your mentor is in the back watching you do your presentation. So he does his presentation and talks about this next step and this maximum size that could create a white dwarf. And he thinks he's the only presenter. People give him a nice little applause, right? He sits down at his table, and then the person who controls the meeting says, "Now we have another presentation by Sir Arthur Eddington, who is now going to refute exactly everything that Chandra has said, because Eddington had known exactly where the faults were. He had worked with him, and he didn't want to be embarrassed by this up-and-coming person showing that his model was in fact wrong." So Eddington got up there and told an aspect, pointing out all the weaknesses in Chandra's work. Now, Chandra's work was just the early part. It was just getting his heat in there. And really embarrassed him. Can you imagine embarrassed with me? Right? Chandra actually left the field of physics for a while. It was really, 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 really crushed. He came, right? He came back in the 1970s to work on it. Now, the eminent physicists at the time, they believed Eddington. After a while, they started working through the equations and working through the modeling, and they started to change one by one to realize that Chandra was in fact correct. And to reward him right now, he won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1983. So sometimes you mean ridicule, it takes a while, and you'll get your just desserts, right? But we have the Chandra telescope in his name, and it's one of the most powerful X-ray telescopes that we have. And some of the images that you'll see that I'll show you come from the telescope named after it. So, very important role of what Chandra did. Two other gentlemen, Walter Bain, Fritz Zwicky, right? They looked at these other astronomical events called supernovae. So they're looking in the skies and they're seeing these things called supernovae. So they're trying to piece together what causes this astronomical event called a supernova. Keep in mind, this whole concept of general relativity is now in the background. Okay, the mathematics is inside it, people are just having fun with it. And now the astronomers doing their stuff here. So the two of them together, they put together a process. And in this process, they said we needed another object more dense than a white dwarf, made of some element called neutrons, that would power and be a leftover remnant of this colossal explosion. And that these are some of the radio sources that are radio telescopes and that telescopes are picking up. These are the bright light things that we're starting to see. These are what these things are. These are some stellar object undergoing a transition from one star to this strange thing that has a lot of neutrons in it. And this is the energy being released. Not the whole picture was there, but these two people put major roles. Along came Oppenheimer. Now, when you think of Oppenheimer, what do you think of? Yeah, the atomic bombs. He's an astrophysicist. He's one of the best specialists in black holes. He showed that this object, which has neutrons, which they're going to call a neutron star, right, had a maximum mass. And he came up with this calculation, someplace around 1.5 to 3. And he said that if you go above this, it should collapse even further to this strange Schwarzschild object. Remember the event horizon, that whole thing? It should collapse through that and become something. Remember, the term black hole wasn't there at that time. It should become something which we call a singularity. Be crushed into something with infinite density and zero volume. Now, and again, depends how you look at this. Serendipity or what? To put all these things together to see if this thing actually made sense, somebody had to do calculations to try to figure out what makes a star work, how does a star work, so these processes can in fact take place. We're just taking pictures through the telescopes, we see these things. What is the chemical process that takes place here? It requires computers. Back then, computers required billions of dollars. Universities could not buy computers. The military could. They used the military in World War II to try to figure out how the sun works. What is the nuclear engine of a sun? How does a star work? And then, of course, the military says, show us how to utilize that same process to build a weapon. But the scientists want to understand how the dynamics of stars work, how the stars burn. And this is exactly why a lot of these scientists got involved in this. You'll notice mostly the astronomers that are involved, astrophysicists that are involved on these projects, were involved for understanding not about building a weapon, but understanding, use the computers and all the best teams to figure out how does the star burn fuel? How does it work? He also, there's another gentleman that comes up by the name of Wheeler, because when he produced his work, he showed that it collapsed into a black hole. And then a gentleman by the name of Wheeler, who is one of the authors of this book, right, didn't believe in black hole. And again, had a major argument with Oppenheimer. And Oppenheimer, never forget, Wheeler went to apologize. Actually, Wheeler figured out, in fact, black holes all possible, and he became the best proponent and produced some of the best books on black holes that we have. He tried to apologize to Oppenheimer, but Oppenheimer was so, I guess, hurt by his fellow person ridiculing him in public that he never forgave him. So again, these are the sad stories. Yakov Zeldovich, not only in the United States, Were they working and understanding these things? Yes. In the Soviet Union, they too needed nuclear weapons. They too had their astrophysicists trying to figure out how the sun works so they could build up that aspect at the same time they were bombing. This guy was the Russian, or I guess the Soviet version of Oppenheimer. Okay? He actually had some of the, once the wars were all over, his team of astrophysicists was the best team. They produced so many results. His major claim to theory was he's the one that put all the pieces together, create the chain of nuclear reactions that demonstrates how a star burns fuel. He also worked on black holes and this thing called quasars, and generated these are the generators of quasars. But he wasn't perfect because he also thought that all volcanoes were generated by nuclear weapons, or not nuclear weapons, nuclear reactions under the core. And that's what we got over there. So he wasn't perfect, but he did push the development of it. John Wheeler, remember I said, the person had a fault bomb hanger, co-author of this book, plus Penny Moore, being down here a couple of times. With Bohr, developed the version of nuclear fission, he put together a catalog he tried to put together the life cycle of stars. What happens when a star grows old? Okay. So he categorized different astronomical versions. Had a major battle about black holes, retracted, became a major component. He's the dude that coined the term black hole. You know what? It's the sexiest name for this object. We sat there and called it a collapsed singularity. The public wouldn't care about it. Like the general public, you talk about the term black hole. There's a sexiness in that term. It's like a black hole, right? It brings all sort of connotation, visualization, stuff like that. I think he did more with this one statement and people getting interested in reading about black holes than anything else, just by creating the name. He also created the phrase, a black hole has no hair. Yeah, we'll talk about that.
No.
Oh, yeah. No. Yes. Roger Penrose. Hopefully some of these names you start taking the history. These guys are putting it together. Speculating that black holes lose their hair by radiating it away. Again, whatever hair is. He also discovered that spinning black holes store energy in the space outside their horizon. Discovered that the sensitivity of black hole must increase. Did that in conjunction with Hawking. Proved that black holes must have a singularity at the core. And we'll get into that. And something called the cosmic censorship conjecture, which ties into this name about the hair. Plus, his major role, he worked on black holes, not from a geometric perspective, but from another mathematical field, topology. Two different fields. He used topology to describe a black hole. Because topology compares the similarities between objects. Just like a mug, which has a handle, is similar topologically to a donut. It's the same property, even though they're physically different, they have the same properties. And in doing so, he created these beautiful called Penrose diagrams. I've got some information about Penrose diagrams on the handout that I gave you. Today's stars, some of them you'll recognize. Stephen Hawking. Susskind, Robert Wall from Israel, Kip Thorne, Bekenstein. These are some of the names that you've seen. These are the major players that are running around doing a lot of stuff with black holes. Each one has his major area of expertise. Now, there are thousands of other people here working on it. But these are some of the major players that have made a major role in the last couple of years. Some of the people here are adding to that. This is what they, this is the story that they put together. Stars have a life cycle. They start with something called a protostar, and depending upon their mass, follow different paths. Some become white dwarfs, some become neutron stars. Some become black holes. Sometimes what happens is they put all this information together and it produces the most elegant diagram. This is the most, this for astronomers, this is the most important, the most famous diagram that we have. It's called the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram or the HR diagram. Temperature and luminosity of the two axes. It gives us a snapshot of what the stars that we see through our telescopes, why they appear at certain colors, where they are, how long they're going to live, and then in the process.
It's not a paradigm, right? It's actual magnitude.
Right, it's the luminosity, right, which is the actual amount of energy that's kicked out, right? And make that here is the path of our sun. Now, our sun right now is right here on that diagram. It's nice and yellow, burning away, right? Being there. We call this the main sequence. This is where they spend most of the time, which is good for us, because our sun's about 4.5 billion years old, and you can see that it's going to be about 9 billion years on the main sequence, so we've got another, our sun's about middle age, right? So he's going to live about 90, 45 now. That's the way of thinking about it, right? But then, when he gets a bit older, something's going to happen to the internal chemistry, and his color's going to change, and the energy coming out is going to change, and he's going to end up going over here. Where is he? I can probably use this little guy right here. He's going to come over here and become something which we call a red giant. Then some change is going to take place. He's going to come back towards it, but he can't hang in there. And he's going to head over and become a red supergiant. And you can see some of the phases. 1 billion years over here, 100 million years over here, then something's going to happen, and he's going to slide over here, and then get less and less exciting, and just slowly fade away down to there, and you can see that each stage he has less time, right? So that's the path of our sun. So we know exactly what's going to happen to our sun. We know it's going to swell up, the surface area of the sun, right? The would, and I'm using that term very loosely, would come to about the Earth, actually come to where the Earth's orbit is. That's how big the sun's going to get. We will be cooked long before that, so we should be on our little spaceships getting out of here. So it gives us a picture of how stars live and die. Fuel. This is the proton-proton change. I'll just let you look at the next sort of animation and read all this stuff. But basically, for hydrogen, produce one helium plus energy. Okay? Energy is the equivalent of the difference between mc squared, and that is the heat that we get from the sun. This is what generates the sun. Remember, this is the process that was produced, mostly understood by Zelovich, and it's this step-by-step process. So, by the way, this is just a picture when all this energy, looking at the energy that's being released, and you can see these little neutrinos, these little strange particles coming up. Part of the understanding when this chain was taking place is, where are the neutrinos? And lucky for us that this object, which is about two of the 10 kilometers from here in Sudbury. This is the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, in a mine in Sudbury. Its job is to find and detect and count neutrinos, to see if the amount of neutrinos coming from the sun matches the hypothesis. Because neutrinos, as you mentioned, remember you heard very energetic? It takes usually light years of light to stop them. It's really, really energetic. You've got uncountable numbers going through us all the time. So they put this huge thing with heavy water and all these photo detectors, special detectors down underground in Sudbury, and all it does is count neutrino flashes to see if this was in fact happening. There's a little story about some of the paradox and how they helped discover that neutrinos do have mass. It's very interesting. The next cycle that they showed, of course, was the carbon nitrogen oxygen cycle. A bit more complex as an energy source, but it produced, again, more energy, but the elements were a bit heavier. Again, you don't need to really memorize this. It's just understanding there are different processes that took place in burning fuel. This one required stars with more mass than, as you said, that you see right here. Stars less than one, but one solar mass left, really like a proton-proton cycle, but they can start burning different fuels. And there are other elements as well. You can actually build up the elements through some sort of a reaction. Some of them take place inside stars themselves, right? To build up to this thing called iron. And the problem is we have to stop there. No problem. Yes?
Why would it have iron?
Because you want to get energy out of the process. To go to the next element up takes energy. It takes more energy to produce the next element than this. So every other element to build up, you get free energy out of it. To go up to iron, to go up to the next one, you have to put more energy in. That's no fun for stars if you want to burn. Okay? Can I show that? And if you look at periodic table, you actually see how this all lies in. You'll probably get it probably in your last year of chemistry about how this works. So, with this energy, we have a star of large mass, which is trying to the gravity, is trying to collapse. It's the thermonuclear energy, right, which tries to blow a star apart. And the star gets itself in a perfect balance. Remember we talked about the main sequence. Right? A star on a stable balance will stay there for our time, hopefully another 4.5 billion years. It may burn up more fuel, it may be less fuel as it works its way up the chain, but it's in a perfect, perfect balance. So it's the pressure balance of a star. Thermal pressure equals force of gravity. Voila, one star. We know about atoms. You know more about atoms than this simple little modified little model right here. Mostly empty space. Now, why is this important? We have our star. It's burning fuel. It runs out of fuel. It burns out of fuel, runs out of fuel. Gravity is still there. It starts trying to compact the star. The star starts to shrink. It's going to start to shrink to become some object. But how far can the star shrink? Well, it shrinks to, and it stops, tremendous mass by what we call electron degeneracy pressure. This is basically, the electrons are all shoved so that we have this degenerate gas, the upspin, downspin. That's all we can do. They're all pushed together so that we can't put any more. You can't violate this rule anymore. I'm not going to make you do that. Okay, I can have you actually calculate the value. I'm going to give you these numbers. But it's very interesting. Notice everything here depends on the number of electrons, g again, mass of an electron, mass of a proton, mass of the object, something called Planck. And we talk about Planck's constant. It appeared here again, right? And in doing so, it would actually give you the radius of it. This is what Chandra calculated. He actually figured out what was the pressure that would drive this thing down to, right? And if you plug in the numbers, that gives you that. I tell you how many of these guys there are, you get something in the order of 10 to the 7 meters. This is how big, this is what Chandra said is the size of this white dwarf. He actually figured out that all white dwarfs will collapse to this size as long as you had a certain mass to begin with. He actually created a limit for the mass because he says, beyond this limit, this electron degeneracy pressure, the electrons themselves are in a strange state, right? If I squish them any further, the electrons become so confined that they oscillate so fast, they become relativistic. And then they can no longer do it, and the next element up has to stop. And the next element that works on there, that's kind of like, so yeah, you have a sun. So, then we talk about it. So it burns all the fuel. As it burns all the fuel, it gets bigger and bigger, and it puffs off the outer part. It's burning the outer part of the fuel. So it starts burning on the inside, slowly burns on the outside. As it burns on the outside, it keeps pushing the other side, the stuff outside any further away. And it should become this huge, big thing with something in the middle. So this is what the theory says. And what's left in the middle is a white dwarf, and we lose about 80% of the mass of this object should be over here, outside the star, at the white dwarf, about 20% in the middle. And the last equation we did was exactly how big it was. The equation wasn't that difficult, but this is what the theory said should happen. So, exhausted, found in the center of things called planetary nebulae. They do exist. They should have solar masses less than 1.4. So he figured out any above that would go to the next stage. And they should be about the same size of the Earth. So this is a mathematical simulation of what a white dwarf should look like. But same size as the Earth. So this is 1.4 of our suns, but same size as the Earth. If these things do exist, because it's all mathematical. And then a major revolution in telescopes and photography took place. And we're looking for things that had something in the middle with all the star stuff blown away on the outside. So if these things did exist, should they not look like that? White dwarf, blown out. White dwarf. You can actually see you can sense the energy. Now these are actual stars. You can sense the energy being blown away from these things. Yes. Well, you can create from the best, and they call them nebula because on the earlier telescopes they were just fuzzy. They didn't know what they were. We can now resolve these things, and we know. Remember, I said all the pieces come together. That thing in the middle is very slight. Now remember, we're looking at the radiant energy coming out, so it's being blasted out in our detectors. It's actually a foot, so our detectors make it seem as big than it really is. Well, every day they go bigger. They're stretching, and then they will get further and further. They still radiate because the white dwarf's sucking out energy, and this is like a plasma. So it's just like the glowing neon science, which are energized, so they will get light years, they will get bigger and bigger, but they get more and more dim as they separate the wood and stuff like that. And it becomes star stuff, other stars that run from the form, and it's a nice little genesis, this whole process. But isn't it kind of neat that our mathematical modeling, the ideas, and then all of a sudden the telescopes find these objects in the right numbers, with the right mass, and the right properties. This is my favorite. It's called the Eskimo. That, you know, because if you're going to pour, this is from the Hubble. If you're going to tell us what's not as good as the Hubble, this looks like a little face. And this looks like the park of an Eskimo. The big fur going around. So the Eskimo.
What was the previous one called?
Let's have a look at that. This one hasn't got a name. It probably does have a name. It's probably got a catalog name. This one's actually a very recent one. I pulled this one up about a couple of months ago. So it's probably got what we usually have is a technical name, right? An NGC name and stuff like that.
Okay.
Whoever does it will create their own name for it. So that means that they haven't come up with a good name yet. Usually they let their kids name them.
Steam Mac Nebula.
We'll put forward a proposal. So, Chandra says the maximum mass for a white dwarf is 1.4. This is what he came out with. Above that, electron degeneracy pressure can no longer hold it. It's going to collapse into something full of neutrons. Above this, can you feel the tension? Above this, even electron degeneracy pressure cannot counterbalance the gravity. What is a plate of a star more massive than this? It's going to be a
black.
No. It's going to be a supernova. Oh. In the depth, In the depth of high mass of star. Now, it says 40 solar masses. Remember, most stars lose most of their energy burning off stuff. Okay? So, it says the high mass, the pressure overcomes the electron degeneracy pressure. The electrons become relativistic, and actually the next element down there has to take place. We know it's going to be neutrons. But what happened is, it can no longer hold, and when it collapses, pressure is so strong, it collapses like this. Right? First, you know, do you hear the resonance on the wall when I did that? That bouncing back is exactly what occurs. It collapses in, and it collapses so violent, it can actually blow apart the star. Hasta la vista, baby. Right? So, but if it collapses in a more controlled, now I say it's more controlled, yeah, we're talking microseconds about the collapsing here, something neat can happen. So it says, so we what happens to the stuff that's inside there? So we have a couple of types of supernova. Type 1As, that's actually type 1A, Bs and Cs, we have type 2. So type 1As, these are not exciting for black hole people. Right? Because they usually come from a previously white dwarf that was so a companion star. And so between the two stars, the white dwarf, right? Remember, it can only grow to a mass of 1.4. After a while, it would normally get smaller and radiate away. But if it's got a companion, it starts eating some of the companion star's surface. And then once it goes above 1.4, it can no longer hold itself and it has to collapse. And when it collapses, it's an ugly collapse because it takes away sometimes the companion star, right? And you're left up with a huge supernova explosion, but no remnants. Now, it's great for cosmologists because we know it triggers at 1.4. Right? This white dwarf explodes, but collapses and causes supernova at 1.4. And we know the size of every one of them. So if we know the size, and we know that we're making the assumption that with the same size, basically same material, the same amount of energy being released, the explosion should basically be the same, we can use it as a yardstick to measure distance. So if it's further away, it should be dimmer. If it's closer, it should be brighter. We can use this as a stepping stone for measuring distances. This is what people like Wendy Friedman did when they tried to figure out the cosmos for constantly expanding the universe and this whole thing. These are one of the things that they use. Type 1A supernova. We're more interested in type 2s, right? This is where a big red giant collapses. Its explosion leaves a neutron core behind. Yes?
Why does it leave a neutron star at the core?
Because, well, I'll show you the next slide, but the electrons can no longer hold itself, and they're basically rammed in together, and something interesting happens when you get electrons and protons, because the pressure is so high that the neutrons and the protons can no longer bound it. They become free, and something interesting, you take one electron and one proton and squeeze them together. Like that. You get this object, right? Creating a neutron, right? So you take electron, proton, squashing together. But look at this. The size of this star, which is about 1.4, remember, 1.4, less than that, you've got a white dwarf. About 1.4, you've got a neutron star. And the same star is the size of 6. So more than 1.4 size of the city, 20 kilometers, a sugar cube would weigh 400 billion tons. The angular momentum has to be conserved, and therefore one of our days would be like 0.001 of their seconds. They spin pretty fast, and they produce huge magnetic fields. Solves neutron star. About in 1968, okay, remember, this was models. 1968, these Dupuy, Bell, and Hewish were using radio dishes, and they were hearing this strange. They had this little tape. Here's a copy of the of one of the tapes of the Crown Pulsar, right? Going tick, 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 tick. You know, initially thought they actually made contact with intelligent species. Why? Because they didn't think no natural process could tick so fast and so regularly. Right. And so they send out messages and nothing happened. But they put it together. They said, well, look, our mathematical modeling said that we should create this neutron star. This neutron star should have a magnetic field. If it has a magnetic field, it's like a giant lighthouse with beams of energy coming up to the poles. If the poles happened to flash in front of us at Earth, we would pick up this radio frequency. We'd hear it as a tick, as every time a pole flashed by. One tick for one pole, another tick for the next pole. Tick, tick, tick. This is exactly what they were getting. They actually discovered, visually, not in visual observatory or radio observatory, they located an object they called a pulsar, which is really a neutron star. So pulsars and neutron stars. So now they've actually seen these things. Stands for pulsating stars, and now known to be spinning neutron stars. Some interesting little animation graphics. We'll just let this thing run for a second of supernova, and I'm going to take you inside one. So it's kind of neat to look at the. And some computer animations of the colossal energy being released. I'm going to take you inside one called the Crown Nebula, which was observed in China in their records. And the star became so bright it was visible in the daytime. Now they had no clue what it was. All they knew is all of a sudden you had an object so bright that became visible in the daytime. We point our telescope and we'll show you what happened. I've got different images from different telescopes, different levels, take us inside this Crown Nebula in a second. And it's going to show us exactly what we see when we pointed to this Crown Nebula. But these are some mathematical simulations of the events of a supernova. Here's a typical picture of the Crown Nebula. If you had the Hubble point to the Crown Nebula, and take a picture. You can see the colossal energy being blown apart, right? The star has spurt star stuff all over the place. I'm going to take this little box. I'm going to zoom in. So now I'm just looking inside. Look here. You can almost sense some sort of circular something happening here. Can you sense it? I'm going to go to another telescope image. Different frequencies, different. Guess what we're looking at?
Not a neutron star.
A neutron star. Right? So we're looking at the process stepping inside. Now, we have to use this in different telescopes. So the first one has a beautiful color, pretty, put on the wall poster, right? Done by the Hubble. But then I had to use different telescopes at different frequencies because we want to punch inside. And we're trying to extract. And you can sense some of the dynamics activity. Something, you can almost sense something spinning in there. Even the previous picture, you can sense something in there spinning, causing ripples within the surface area of the dust that's around it. And you can sense the what we call the jets coming out of the sun.
Like 20-kilometer area or something?
Well, inside there would be a dot. If you had the ultimate telescope zone, all we can look at is energy, and the dot itself would be about 20 kilometers, right? But our telescopes aren't that good. And even if we put new ones, they aren't that good. We could just look at how it affects. It makes the gas around it radiate. So we see the light from the central core the best we can, but not the actual star. No matter, most telescopes, all telescopes, all stars should have their own source.
See, how large is that
image? That one I couldn't tell you unless of the specifications. But I would expect that this is close to maybe solar system size. Right? So it is the effects are very, very large because the mass still has the mass of the of 1.4 of our sun, so the effects would be similar as a sun, a star about 1.5 times the size of our sun. So let's just reiterate what we got. Low mass stars, less than 8. Now remember, I said less than 8 is when it burns off about 80% of its surface area. But when it does that, it becomes a white dwarf, held together by electron degeneration pressure. Higher mass stars, about 40 solar masses, when they blow away all of their stuff, they become neutron stars, and they have masses between 1.4 and 3 solar masses. And they're held apart by neutron degeneration pressures. And remember, the neutron came from the combining of electrons and protons and became neutrons. So the question is, what next? Right, neutron stars helped by that. Have that. What would happen if a high mass star is so big that its central core is bigger than this? What would happen if gravity is stronger than even neutron degeneration pressure? How dense can somebody get? How strong can the force of gravity be? What if the escape velocity is faster than the speed of light? What do we get?
A steamer!
So finally, we make ourselves. But I wanted to before just talking about it, I wanted to take you the journey. Remember, we've got about 5 minutes, so I'll just get into this. But tomorrow we start off at the end of all the cool stuff, black holes. But understand, I started off with the talk, and I said, about 30 years ago, I asked all the cosmologists how many would believe. And I said, only maybe one or two, right? Not very many, right? Maybe 10, maybe 5, I'm not sure, right? So I asked today, and the number is about 98, 99%. Why? Because in the 30 years, we put together a physical process, how stars work. What happens when they get big? Do we see throughout our scientific equipment what the mathematical theories tell us? And in doing so, everything that the theories have said, the strange thing about white dwarfs, the strange phenomena of neutron stars, right? Star bigger than the sun, the size of a city, spinning so fast that a day is like, you know, one thousandth a second. The next step says, well, if those are all true, shouldn't the next step up in the equation says that we should now have a black hole? And that's where I'm going to stop today. They say it's like same back time, same back channel. Tomorrow, we're going to take you. I'll just take you right through the black hole. I'll show you the anatomy. We'll show you the fun stuff. We're going to actually fall into a black hole. We don't fall into a black hole, right? And indeed, because I did it. guys, there's a lot of stuff here. You've just seen about 30 years of history, right? And 30 years of history has been verified, not just by fancy pictures, but verified by some
of the